Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. It is a new year. I wasn't smart enough to get the 2022 thing, like that this is another year of 2020. I had to have it explained to me. So that's really dumb. I am happy that 2021 is over. Super happy.
Yeah, but this is 2022. Also.
It's just, that's depressing.
People it's just in church. To be one long year.
Yeah. People in church yesterday were like, New Year. Like, nobody's, people were not saying, I was saying Happy New Year. And people were like, New Year. New Year. It's already
it is
not.
Indeed a new year.
It's like saying that it. That is a baby. When you meet somebody's beautiful baby. Sure every baby is beautiful, though. As opposed to every new year isn't already nice.
We don't make resolutions, so we don't have to have a show talking about resolutions.
I do. I make resolutions. I wrote a whole article about how I make resolutions.
I thought your article was that you don't make resolutions.
No, I said I... Oh. I said I made
they just
resolutions.
Don't, and fail, and they become just don't make them law, right?
I said, yeah, I said don't make a vow to God.
Oh, right, yes.
So that when you
break your resolution,
you become a liar. Make it like guidelines or suggestions, not like
a New Year's suggestion.
I'm gonna sacrifice whoever comes out of my house first. After I win this battle, I'm going to slaughter that person. And then you're like, what should I do?
Don't keep it.
Should I keep my vow?
Sorry, Emma. Gonna have to call you now.
So,
it is me. Okay, so we're going to talk about something else today. But
I do make that, resolution, so.
That text is so... So Jeff that just said, well, hey.
I guess.
Now, there is some people think it's like she could, it could be that he gave her over to service in the temple. And so she was weeping because she would never get married. But
I'm going to go with that one.
Yeah,
I prefer that.
It makes Jeff the less of a
horrible, horrible person.
And less or more intelligent. Because the guy would say, okay, I made this promise to God, but it was a bad promise. It was a sin, so I need to go like sacrifice something at the tabernacle.
And say sorry.
Because I know that God would not want me to kill my daughter.
But you know, the judges in the book of Judges,
yeah, that's the
a
whole
lot
point,
of them
right?
were like really stupid. That's the whole point. Yeah. They were all stupid.
Yeah.
Gideon, Samson was the stupidest of the bunch. What should I do? Break every law. I'm going to break every law.
Every single one.
I make resolutions, and I made my resolutions yesterday. I wrote them down. I actually track them by year. I have like notes from starting in like 2016 or something.
Yeah.
Of all my resolutions, so I'm going to add my new resolutions to all my old ones so that I can see that over time I've become a more functional person. One year, for instance, I resolved to do that email thing where you it's called Ohio, you only handle it once. So you don't open an email unless you're prepared to answer the email or the text. And I did that for a year. It was really great. I was like much more on top of things. But then the year after that, there was like this explosion of different kinds of ways that people could message you. It wasn't just email. There was Facebook Messenger, Twitter Messenger, Instagram Messenger, Signal, Voxer.
Oh my gosh.
Texting, and it all fell apart. And so now I routinely lose messages to people and I don't respond in a timely manner. because I accidentally open things. And all of these platforms can tell people that you're on them and they can see that you're there.
Yeah.
And so
but I remember, I remember the day that the Messenger changed. Before you could set up Messenger.
You could get an email.
It would tell you got an email in which the whole message is there. So you didn't have to open up Messenger and let the person who sent you the mail know the message, know that you had read it.
And then you could have time to think about what you were going to say.
But they disabled that function.
Yeah.
So now you just, I'm really still mad at them
for doing all these years later. There's a lot of reasons to be angry at Facebook, and that's one of the biggest ones. Well, anyway, so you're obviously not going to resolve to use social media less in 2022.
How do you know that? How do you know? You don't know? I actually don't make resolutions, but how do you know I'm not going to use it less?
I just have this feeling. Like I can just, I'm intuiting that you're not backing up on social media use.
I actually have backed up on social media use.
That's true.
I don't use Facebook nearly as much. And I don't use Twitter all that much. I mean, I post maybe once a day, but twice a day, but, recently.
In the new year.
And I didn't even think it was going to blow up this much, but, I tweeted a screenshot of something that Kristen Dumais, who wrote Jesus and John Wayne, posted, and that didn't.
People were really mad at you.
People were very angry with it, but not anyone that on my friends list, but or people who follow me, but people who follow her were angry because she retweeted what I said, and then Jamar Tisby retweeted what I said, and then. Kyle J. Howard.
I thought you were blocked by those people.
I thought I was too, but I know I was blocked by Kyle J. Howard, but I guess he unblocked me for that purpose. So not, but Kristen DeMay's never blocked me. I've never blocked her either. But I actually had a good exchange with her, an interesting exchange with her. But maybe we should read the tweet because it's kind of interesting.
By kind of interesting, you mean that. You enjoyed yourself very much.
Well, yes, I did enjoy myself because this means, okay, so let me read what I wrote. Let me read what she said, and then I'll read what I wrote. And because this is basically what we're going to talk about today, because it goes to what we've talked about before. We've discussed Kristen Dumais' book and why we both think it's not a good book. Not talking about the writing, but about the content.
The writing is pretty sarcastic and scathing.
Right.
It's not like a cool, dispassionate historical account of anything, which she has been very open that that's not what she was trying to do. Like she was polemical on purpose in the book.
Right. And then gets angry when people are polemical in response.
Yeah.
All right. So this occurred, I can't tell how long ago this occurred, but so this person asked her a question. Hey, Dr. Dumais, do you have any tips on how the average person can analyze power and cultural systems so that we aren't held captive by them? Your book exposes what we've been experiencing, but I wonder if there's anything else we need in order to inhabit this time more wisely.
So that's like a question that already has an answer embedded in it.
Right.
No, it's not really a question.
Right. I mean, the assumptions under the question is that, we are held captive by systems and there needs to be some way to analyze those systems to enable us to get out of them or to undo them, undo the power. Right. So there's already kind of a, the binary we've talked about between oppressed, oppressor, power, no power, that binary is already there in the question. And so Kristen DeMay responds, I should have a better answer, but for me, it wasn't one source, but years spent reading social and cultural histories. Histories of gender, Foucault, Gramsci, Adorno, Habermas, learning to be curious about how the works work. Okay. Now we'll talk about those guys in a minute, who they were or are. But Habermas is still alive, I believe. But my response was, I tweeted it out. Remember when we said that Jesus and John Wayne isn't really an historical analysis, but a Marxist ideological interpretation of history, and that Dumay isn't a historian, but an ideologue? This is a question mark. I left it like that. And so that then
created a firestorm.
The inner tubes blew up after that. So, but I still haven't been ratioed. I'm at 204 likes here and not, and 40 retweets. And of those, your ratio is when someone, you have more comments on your, more comments and quote tweets
than likes.
Than likes on your.
It means you said something bad.
And people are trying to cancel you. People are trying to cancel you.
I do love a good ratio. Yeah. I really do. I love a good ratio. They say, I'm just here for the ratio.
Right. So now I was, it's Twitter. So I didn't say in my original tweet, is what I probably should have said. Is it, you know, and this is where Kristen DeMay rightly objected. She's not a Marxist. I mean, I don't mean that when I wrote this, I didn't mean that she's like she's a member of the Marxist Party or a Marxist Party or.
Well, they don't give out cards anymore. Right. Do they give out cards?
I don't know if they give out cards, but I didn't mean that she's an actual card carrying communist person. And I should be more clear. You know, there's classical Marxism. So a classical Marxist historian would be analyzing history from the perspective of class theory and attempting to show how history is moving in a certain direction, the direction that Marx identified toward full communism, and explaining explaining historical events as if they are fully in line with the Marxist understanding of history and class struggle. So, you know, the Marxist historian goes to history with an agenda. You know, we're going to show how history is bearing out my ideology. And so necessarily, you know, you're going into a study with that idea of history, you're going to have conclusions that meet or match. You're going to try and make it so that your conclusions match the ideology that you go into. Now, so Dumay is, and others with her are not classical Marxists. They're not analyzing history through class struggle.
I mean, most people aren't doing that anymore.
No, I mean, there are some, but I mean, that's not.
Yeah.
But the sort of history that she does is Marxist in character. So like she mentions, well, let me back up here. So in the early 20th century, late 20s or so, Marxists began to expand Marx's understanding of the way history works and extend his analysis of culture, extend his analysis beyond economy to culture and to power and to
sex.
Well, sex too, right? Everything. So that, you know, Marx had this idea that everything could pretty much be reduced down to class struggle. So the proletariat, the working class, was eventually going to take hold of the means of production. The means of production being held by the bourgeois and the elites, and the working class were just, you know, they were the ones who were actually producing goods, but not enjoying the goods they produce. So that's going to change ultimately, said Marx, and ultimately the proletariat is going to take hold of the means of production, and we'll have distributed, kind of distributed justice. But in the 20s, the idea was, okay, let's expand this beyond economy and class and think about just power in general, like hegemony. It's not just about the working class, it's about the oppressed peoples of the earth, who are struggling under the hegemonic power, cultural power of the elites. And I guess by now, people have, you know, it includes the rich, includes the colonizers, it includes men, it includes whatever, I guess in our society, a neo-Marxist might say white people, males, people who have power. The way it's talked about now is privilege, right? So the privilege has become the quoth means of production that the oppressed must, that must be redistributed to the oppressed. So the people she cites in this tweet, Gramsci and Adorno in particular, and somewhat Habermas, those people have that way of looking. They're Marxists. They were actually members of the Communist Party, and but they were part of this expansion of what the Marxist analysis to culture.
So, if you want a really good look at how that happened, you could read Cynical Theories, because they explain in detail. Like, I would have recommended that Kristen G. May read Cynical Theories, but Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay really show how those people listed in that tweet expanded and transformed the way that people thought of communism, too,
right,
and how it came into the academy and in a sort of quiet way, so that people weren't, you know, the proletariat didn't see what was happening
right
under their noses when they sent their children off to college. It's a really good book. I recommend it. I read it in 2021. And then the other one, the last couple chapters of Carl Truman's book deals with Marx and
right.
Foucault and Freud, and he gives a really good, clear picture of kind of how it is that we are in the place where we are because of those writers in particular. So that's the interesting thing to me, is that you could read, you could engage the works of critics of those people to understand, I think, I get a better bird's eye view of what has happened in the last century.
Right.
It's interesting to me that she read those people apparently uncritically. Like,
yeah, well, they
shaped her
how to look at the world, she says, basically.
So interesting, because I read Foucault, and as an undergraduate, I had to read, for some reason, as a literature major, I had a heavy diet of Foucault. And as I was reading it, I thought, this is, you know, what's a good word? This is funny. This is funny. And also not
sex,
real.
He deconstructs sexuality. And
I don't know how you could read Foucault and think that he, for example, that he explains everything. Like, that's interesting to me, that she would uncritically read these texts and not have a check in her spirit as a Christian to say these are good
she would say,
analyses of how things really are.
Right.
Like,
I mean, so you can
Christians
read,
should engage with these texts and be able to criticize them. But in this case, it seems that they critiqued her view of the world rather than the other way around.
She's adopted these views of how the world works.
It brought them into, quote, Christianity. And I would say they're not compatible with a Christian worldview.
No, this goes back to us. So when people talk about critical theories, and it's, you don't want to say critical theory, critical theories, they're all rooted in this kind of expansion of Marxist analysis. They all are. And so shorthandedly, you can say, yeah, this is a Marxist analysis. If I were asked to, like, what would you expect of someone who is kind of bathed in these kinds of works? How would you expect a person to analyze American evangelicalism? Then if Jesus and John Wayne had not been written, that's the book that you'd expect to be written by someone who's just bathed in this way of thinking. Because what as we said many times when we talked about the book, it's like a Marxist analysis. It's like a classical Marxist analysis, except it's not. It's a cultural Marxist.
It's a cultural analysis,
right?
Of power,
right?
And the apparent motivations of people, but not what they themselves would say were their motivations, but what Dumé and others know that they are motivated by, even though they,
because their ideology tells them so.
Even yeah,
right. So Marxist, a classical Marxist would look at American evangelicalism and say, okay, economic class desire is class will is driving everything. So the evangelical Republican person is really trying to protect his class interest, right? So how is that working, and how can the proletariat one day? So the evangelical person might say, oh no, see, I think that the Bible teaches us that we're not supposed to murder babies, so I'm against abortion, so I'm going to be voting Republican. The classical Marxist would say, no, you're interested in protecting your class, and abortion helps the I don't think it does, but a classical Marxist would say, helps the under the lower classes gain economic footing. So you don't want that. You want to protect your class privilege. So you're, that's why you're acting the way. Christian May's whole book, or not whole, I don't say the whole thing, but it was largely written to explain why so many evangelicals voted for Trump. And so instead of saying, what do they say? What are these people thinking they're doing? And if you asked, I would probably say the majority of people who voted for Christians who vote for Trump, evangelicals who vote for Trump, it was, I would say the number one thing was abortion. I bet
the, but vast, it also did, I mean, there was a real, there was economic, I mean, it, in the aftermath of the Trump election, elite, speaking of class issues, elite scholars from big institutions went out into the boondocks to try to understand why, quote, people would vote against their own self-interest. So the best example of this was a book called Left Behind, which was a Princeton professor who conducted research in the heartland of America and tried to find real Trump voters and talk to them. And he tried to paint a sort of a nuanced picture of why people would vote for Trump. And I guess I'd never read it, but the bigger one was Hillbilly Elegy. That was a big book that came out to try to explain that people in the banlieue, or in the, you know, the boondocks, don't actually have a great deal. They've got a lot of heroin, and they've lost all of their meaningful work over several generations, and they are beleaguered and poor, and their lives are miserable. And so they, Trump tapped into that population, and it got it on his side. And that would, so yeah, there were a lot of reasons why people voted, but it wasn't to protect power that existed.
Right.
Really. It was more to try to, his pipe dream of having a better life, and not being lectured by the elite. That was a big, big thing. The condescension of the elite through the Trump years just kept, that's what he kept saying. Well, that's why you have Trump. If you would stop talking that way, you might have less Trump, but nobody could stop.
Well, and so, but many Christians, and I would say that.
Right, but she was analyzing Christians. You're right about that.
Who did vote for Trump did so by holding their nose. I mean,
yeah.
But
the ones we know,
it was the alternative to Biden, and
well, no, it was the alternative to Hillary Clinton. Oh, that's first, another thing. Like, again, nobody wants to talk about the fact that the other party put up a candidate who was so
loathsome.
And that just always gets missed, as if that Trump was picked out of a vacuum and not choosing between two terrible options.
Right. So, but her, the conclusion is, the reason why we've come to this point where so many evangelicals voted for Trump, is because evangelicalism has bound itself to misogyny, racism, and militant masculinity.
Masculine.
So all of those are bound up together, and evangelicalism is a system that protects those things now. It's become that, which is a clearly Marxist way of viewing, a culturally Marxist way of viewing, of viewing history. Now, people in the thread have said, and Christian DeMay came back and said, well, everybody analyzes history through a lens, an ideological lens. And I would say yes and no. I mean, if you mean everybody comes to the study of history with an ideology or with a point of view, yes, of course. And everybody's influenced by that. No, no one, I agree that you can't have, no one can have a perfectly objective view of history.
I mean, good historians find their views corrected by the record of history. That's
okay. There's the key. So I'll make an analogy with biblical exegesis. I also agree that we are human beings, and so we come to the Bible with all kinds of lenses and in view, cultural lenses and view. However, I think it's possible to come to a correct interpretation of a text that corrects your own theology coming in. So most Christians have probably had this experience where you read the Bible, you say, oh my goodness, it says this, but not that. My expectations of what, and my beliefs about what is right and wrong have been totally, completely transformed by my study of this book. Most don't come to the book, and I mean, Christians should not come to the book and say, okay, now I'm going to find ways to defend my, I'm going to find ways in which my ideology is affirmed or confirmed by this book. That would be eisegesis, not exegesis.
Which most, incidentally, most evangelicals do. Narcegesis.
Right, right.
Like most, well, that's a broad sweeping generalization that I shouldn't make. So many people in America don't know how to read the Bible at all.
Right.
And so it wouldn't be surprising to find that they couldn't read other kinds of books either, or the historical record.
Right. So coming to, say, a history of the rise of, I'm going to do my favorite thing here, the rise of Nazism in Germany, right? A good historian would not come in with an intention of doing a class analysis and finding out how this really affirms or confirms Marx's theory of history, or come in to do a power analysis and show how this really is about no matter what people said at the time they were doing or thought they were doing, this is really about power. It might be about power, but you'd go in and say, okay, let me see, what were the motivations? What are people thinking they're doing? And in the time, how do people reason through their choices and their ideas? And so you just analyze that. You put the data on the table and say, okay, well, this is what people thought they were doing, and these are the factors in play, economic, cultural, whatever.
It's a little bit like the scientific method, which is also broken now. People don't know how to do science either, which is where you collect data.
Right.
You try to look at the data. You don't come in. Bad science is where you already know the outcome. And it used to be possible. I feel like a few years ago, used to be possible to go to a bit of science and sciencey things and analyze things and learn something. That's like how we learned about things like, I don't know, electricity and stuff. Right. But you know, the sort of therapy of the world has come even to science. So the way that scientific data is analyzed is not, no, that's not a, you have to be careful with what science, one of the scientists you're looking
right,
at.
Right. One of the fundamental precepts, I guess, of a critical theorist is that, and this is comes out of postmodernism too, is you can't, no one can escape their context. You can't, there's no possibility of having an objective understanding of something that's true. It's all just perspective, right? So
but that itself is a statement of, that's of itself, reality, right.
I mean, like it's a self-defeating concept, because you're now saying you have a
said something,
right you're now saying you have an objective view of reality, right? So that was kind of interesting, but there's a lot of self-defeating comments on the common thread that nobody escapes this.
Well, neither did you then. You're
not escaping it, so we can't really have a conversation.
That's the interesting thing. Nobody actually lives that way. Right. Even if you are writing or tweeting that kind of thing, you don't actually live that way in your own world. You, when you're making your breakfast in the morning, collect objective data about the heat of the toaster and the way the butter spreads on the bread, and like it's not there are boundaries to your own world that do exist that you don't actually try to blow up all of those things,
right?
It's just some of them are useful to destroy, quoth, for other people, though even for yourself you wouldn't actually live in this kind of world.
Exactly. I mean, one of the tells, like if you're reading a book that purports to be a history, one of the ways you can tell whether you're reading an ideological work or an actual analysis of history is whether you come out with a cartoonish binary. And by this, I mean, if you're reading a work of ideology, then you're going to have really clear good guys and bad guys. You're going to have white hats and black hats. The good guys are either going to be the victims or are going to be the people who are oppressed and trying to overthrow the bad system. And the bad guys are going to be the power holders, the elite, and this kind of ideology. You know, you could I'm kind of describing what you'll find in a critical theory / Marxist history. But if you go back and look at maybe a fascist, when the fascists in Italy and Germany were trying to prove their system, they did the same kind of thing. They go back through history and show, you know, race struggle or same kind of thing. It's just these histories that prove that white people are better.
They're Germanic useless. Races like are better. People than, don't read those history books anymore
because they're useless. So you know, if you come out of a book and you think, wow, white evangelicals are evil, the evangelicalism is wicked, you probably are reading, or anything like Democrats are of the devil. You're reading an ideological trope, not an actual history. Because in actual history, you come out, even though you still, like, and we mentioned, I'll go back to the thing, I've been reading lots of Hitler biographies, right? You come out of a good Hitler biography still thinking, wow, this man was bad. This was an evil man. He did wicked, horrible, awful things. But you also come out with a sense of his humanity, that, oh, I can see in his circumstance why he made that decision. I don't think it's a terrible decision.
It's a bad decision.
But a good historian humanizes the person that he's, or historical biographer, humanizes the person so that you can tell some likeness there. Okay, this is like, this person is like me. We're both human. He was maybe possessed by demons, but we were both human. So I can see the reasoning there. And there's, in other words, no matter how bad things are, you can kind of get a sympathetic view of the other human being you're reading about, beings you're reading about.
What's ironic about that is that's what everybody says, like on social media, there's this, you know, constant barrage of, lecturing about how we should be empathetic and sympathetic and believe everyone, and we shouldn't be narrow, and you know, you should be hospitable, and you shouldn't. But it doesn't go, you know, no one is, speaking of standpoint, no one is really able to, it takes a good writer or God himself to give you empathy for your enemy.
Right.
And what's interesting about Jume's book is that she really coalesced, she brought together all the threads and solidified, she made an enemy for people who were looking for an enemy. She made a demon out of ordinary
Christians.
People. And she did it effectively.
Mm-hmm. Well, because she played on a lot of people having bad experiences growing up within evangelicalism, right? She plays on this kind of...
Right. I mean, she takes data and then she shapes it, and she makes, instead of getting into the minds and in a sympathetic way, helping other people, if she's writing for whatever audience, understand the real motivations and character of people in that world, she shaped it so that you would have someone to hate, and you would have reasons to hate that person, which is the opposite of what everybody says you're supposed to do. I just want to point that out. I think that's one reason why, I mean, there were a lot of reasons why I did not enjoy the book, but,
So there's definitely, I mean, before this new phase of using, you know, quasi-Marxist analysis to undo Christianity or evangelicalism came along, we had many podcasts in which we were critical of evangelicalism. So no one is saying
it's not like American there's nothing
evangelicalism is above critique, but what is the tool by which you're critiquing it? Right. So the tool by which the Christian should critique Christianity or any Christian church or any Christian movement is the scriptures. Right. So it is.
And I would say this is where historians often wreck on the shoals of their own hubris. Most secular historians don't understand Christianity. And so when they try to read and write about the historical record of what happened, say, in the Middle Ages, they are unable to do that because they don't know what Christianity is.
Or what Christians were thinking, why they were thinking that way.
Don't understand Christian theology. They don't know how to read the New Testament. They have no idea. And so they're applying various lenses, trying to understand the behavior of people in the past. So it's really ironic that somebody who claims to be a Christian now is still unable to actually articulate the views of actual Christians now, let alone in the 50s or, you know, the 1900s. There's layers of irony for me.
This dovetails with her, you know, not being able to affirm orthodoxy with regard to sexuality. She's now
rethinking
orthodoxy on sexuality. And of course, that makes perfect sense given her influences and the people that she's reading. Cause then, you know, the objection to same sex marriage and to homosexual relationships isn't theological. It's power, right? It's about the oppressed not being given freedom. So you see through the theology to the real sociological issue, which is power. That's what this kind of thinking does to you. It turns everything into a power analysis. I think she's already departed from the church when she decided not to affirm orthodoxy, and refers to those who are opposed to orthodoxy and sexuality as fellow Christians. To me, she's already outside the bounds of orthodoxy herself. But given her influences,
You can see why.
You can see why, and you can see where she's going. I mean, I pray to God that she will repent of that and turn back to orthodoxy. But But if the trajectory she's on is one in which she's, I would say a few years, she's going to come out and say, or maybe less time, she's going to come out and say, I totally affirm these relationships. And
I mean, she's in a church that does do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she's already, in a church that's affirming and welcoming. And so, in any case, but I don't know how that church works, so I don't want to say much about her church. In any case, the cartoonish kind of figures that emerge from an ideological work are the tell. You're reading an ideological work. And that's all over the place. It was the same thing with Beth Allison Barr's making of biblical womanhood. You had the good guys, you had the bad guys, you had the heroes and heroines, and you had the evil men cackling with their in the dark corners, plotting how to keep women down
out of the Bible, get women out of the Bible.
Yeah, exactly. So same kind of thing. And of course, they're fast friends here. So all this to say is, do you believe that despite our historical context, despite our culture, despite our color, despite our all these things, that human beings are able to not totally transcend, but are able still to grasp the truth of a thing? Or not. And the way you answer that question is really going to determine where you fall on these things. Whether you become a standpoint person and lean toward critical theory, or you don't, and you kind of reject postmodernism and critical theory and Marxist analysis and all the other stuff.
One thing I really like, Twitter is so helpful, but what somebody was saying, the two words woke and based are really actually really helpful. They just sound like sort of things that you call other people, and they're kind of throwaway words now. Like, have they outlived their usefulness? But they are actually helpful, because a woke person has decided that pure subjectivism is a way, which is again an objective thing to say. But I'm yeah. just gonna transcend. Everything I'm going to, my, the subjective realities that I have in view are going to be the lens through which I do everything.
Right.
Based is to say, no, I'm going to take objective, measurable data, evidence, and I'm going to conform myself to those kinds of things.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting, because I didn't really know what based meant. Right. And that's not really how people use it. They don't know that they're trying to use it that way. But what does this dog want?
And so, if you're hearing licking and breathing, that's not me. It's Bunter, our large dog who came up.
He was saying good morning.
Yeah, hello, Bunter.
He's so tired.
Yeah,
it's like 9 o'clock, and he's just
exhausted.
Just exhausted from his long night of sleeping. So,
the other thing is. It was interesting. It came out in the thread, but it's increasingly common is this kind of credentialism. So immediately after I posted this thing on Twitter, people were saying, oh, what are your credentials? Are you a historian? Do you have a PhD? And of course the assumption is if you don't have a PhD, you cannot even analyze these things seriously. Cause
you're just a pastor.
You're just a pastor. Right.
That's what somebody said, like, you're just a pastor or something.
Which is, I mean, itself, it's a logical fallacy. People without high school degrees are capable of analyzing an argument and seeing whether or not it's
learning
right.
Learning things.
Right? And learning things.
Thinking, right? Thinking so, the thoughts.
So we actually worship a Jew who probably didn't go through the credentialing process of becoming a rabbi. And yet, wow, he was... able to analyze things.
He was literally God, though.
Right, right, right. I'm not Jesus, but I'm just saying there's, of course. Did you know that? I'm not Jesus.
I have noticed. I was aware that you.
Right, but we of all people should not be credentialists in that way.
Well, yeah. I mean, that, and also that's, I mean, the Jesus and John Wayne book is written for a popular audience.
Right.
Like, she wants people who are not other academics to read her book and adopt her view.
Right.
So it would then be incumbent on people, ordinary people, to read the book and critique it on the terms with which, like, she shouldn't shift the ground.
Right.
And, I mean, it's interesting that the people that she cites, Foucault in particular, the sort of academic, opaque, hazy writing that came to characterize the last century was meant to intimidate and confuse people and delineate the class issues more clearly so that you would know who was in and who was out, who could understand the text and who couldn't. That's interesting that those are the people she read. That's not, that doesn't make you a clear thinker. There are plenty of academics who can't write. I always wondered, somebody who said anything to me, a friend was saying, the question, it's not if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, did it really fall or whatever. The real question is, if an academic can't write, can the academic think? That's an unanswerable question. Well, we don't know.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed my exchange with her when she came in on the thread. I think she's just, if we didn't talk politics, religion, or culture, I bet we have a nice conversation over Thanksgiving dinner, because she's like a nice person. So this isn't not personal. It's just
that's the other thing. Like, we're dealing in ideas, and that's the problem with Twitter. But I have really been saddened over the last year when somebody goes online or writes something for a big publication or writes a book that's full of ideas that can be engaged with one way or the other. And then you go to engage with those ideas and you critique those ideas strongly based on what they are. And then everybody says, well, you're being needlessly personal, you're not allowed to engage with this work because you're not, well, as some people said about me, you're not from here. And I think, well, no, if you're going to write the work, if you're going to do that work, then you need to gird up your loins and
expect pushback
about the ideas. And when people push back, however badly, about the ideas that you yourself have espoused or written, you need to engage with people about those ideas still.
And this is like, so we've said this over and over again, I feel like we're beating a dead horse, but you know, if you
write publicly about something,
but not just that, but if you're in the way you write about it, if you're, for example, accusing white evangelicals as a group of racism, misogyny, and militancy, or militant masculinity, whatever it is, then you can expect people to respond sharply to that and to use the tone you use, right? So if you're sarcastic, you can't cry when people are sarcastic back to you, or you're angry, you can't be mad
when people are angry.
Respond, right? So if you're hard hitting, you should expect to be hit hard. Not physically,
with words. Words are not violence in this case. So we're using words so that we don't come to blows.
and that's not opposed to charity. I think you said something really interesting to me. We were talking yesterday, but people use charity, but what they really mean is tone. Charity is a word that's connected with truth, right? So.
Caritas.
Love, right? So agape. To say to someone, this book or this writing is untrue, and it's actually in service of a wicked end, and this is an unchristian book, that's not uncharitable. If it's true, if what you're saying is true, that's charitable. You're actually being loving by telling someone the truth. Not all sarcasm is uncharitable. We know that because God inspires sarcasm in the scriptures in certain cases, right? When Elijah mocks the prophets of Baal and wonders whether Baal has gone off to go to the bathroom, that's classic divine sarcasm. And you see it not just in Elijah, of course, you see it all through. Jesus uses it. When he calls Herod a fox, for example, that's a really cutting, biting thing to say. We think of foxes as clever, but for the, in those days, he was basically calling
Herod a wolf.
Yeah, he's going to be essentially. And his Matthew 23, the biting remarks about the Pharisees. My goodness, and of course Paul telling people to go and emasculate themselves. It's all over the place. So it's not necessarily sarcasm is not necessarily opposed to charity. They do coincide. Not always, but
quite it's possible often. To be really, really mean in the way that you tell the truth, and that would be better if you were not mean. But right. But again, I think a sharp tone. If I've said this over and over again, if you find somebody standing next to a precipice in the dark, and you call out to them sharply and say, "Don't step any farther." You might sound mean,
right?
But that's really what I have. When people are reading Beth Allison Barr's book and thinking that it's lovely, and other people call out sharply and say, "That book is not. That book doesn't explain everything the way that you think it does." You know, pause.
Right.
Read some more things. It's not because they hate you. It's because they want you not to deny Jesus and leave the church.
Right.
So, anyway.
I mean, just to answer the credential question, no, I don't have a PhD. I don't have a PhD.
Are you sad about that?
I mean, I wanted a PhD because the time I was going to apply, we had six very small children and I was a pastor, and I had the recommendations, I had the grades, I probably could have gotten in, but it was just, it would have blown up our family. So that's good. My undergrad, and I had 1 year of grad school in history, but my undergrad was in history, and I in particular focus was on Marxism-Leninism. And so, and I didn't stop reading that stuff after my 1 year of grad school. I'm fascinated by it. It's an area of thought that I've been reading about and studying for 20 or some odd years. Now, again, I'm not a PhD, so sure. I'm sure that I don't keep up on the journals. So, I don't publish. I haven't published anything. So I'm not an academic when it comes to this, but I'm not completely nouveau, just listening, just repeating, regurgitating the critiques that I've heard from other people. I do know how this stuff works. The Habermas guy, the one guy who is, Habermas is still alive. He's, German socialist. He's of the three probably the least offensive, but he's a critical theorist, and his thought is rooted in Marxism. He was critical of Marx. In fact, all the people she mentions were critical of Marx in the sense that
he didn't go far enough.
Right, he didn't expand the analysis beyond class, and Habermas in particular is not a historical determinist. History is heading toward full communism. He thought that the introduction of the welfare state within the capitalist systems allayed that. But in any case, they're all of the same in the same milieu. And immersing herself in those ways of thinking would, of course, produce what they produce. Well, we're 54 minutes in.
So,
and my dog,
these dogs are desperate. They need us to stop doing this so they can go out into the snow and not use the house as their latrine today, which is their preference when it snows. It's they went outside. To potty inside, as we say. But well, happy new year. We're in for another long ride. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.